Russia and China have a couple of enormous things in common. Both object to the idea of a world order in which the United States has more power than they do in any realm. And both are actively developing new kinds of covert operations to gain global influence at our expense. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The digital age has radically changed what it means to conduct espionage. Our enemies are seeking data of all kinds that might compromise Americans and our interests, including information stored in corporate vaults as well as government files. This means the U.S. and its allies will need to understand how our data could be used against us and to develop new kinds of defenses as fast as new threats emerge. Calder Walton is assistant director of the Applied History Project and the Intelligence Project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs and author of the book Spies, The Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. His recent article for Foreign Affairs magazine is titled The New Spy Wars. Calder, welcome to Think.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
You start us in this article with a chilling premise, which is that for Vladimir Putin, the Cold War never ended. So he effectively ordered Russia's security and intelligence services to pick up where the Soviet Union left off?
That's exactly right, Chris. So it seems to me that the key to understanding Putin and what we're seeing unfold in Ukraine right now is Vladimir Putin's previous career as a KGB officer. So this was his experience in the KGB shaped his world outlook. And for the KGB, which ostensibly collapsed with the Soviet Union's demise in 1991, in fact, the KGB lived on in Russia in the 1990s. Russia's new intelligence services had different names, the SVR and the FSB, but that changed very little. And in fact, the KGB's ghosts lived on in Russia and became equally powerful, or if not even more powerful, than the KGB in the later Soviet period. And it's exactly out of this sort of area of revenge, of seeing that the United States and NATO were what led to the demise of the Soviet collapse. It's out of that sense of humiliation on the world stage that Russia was far from being not only no longer a superpower, but wasn't really even a great power anymore. It's out of that sort of stew, if you like, that Putin emerges in the 1990s to become head of Russia's security service, the FSB, and then, to the surprise of everyone, to be Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin's successor at the end of the decade. For Putin and the people from his background, the so-called men of force in Russia, the Cold War finished the wrong way, with the West triumphant. And Putin has been consistent in his view since coming into power at the end of the 1990s, that he would do everything he could to seek a rearrangement of the security architecture, international security architecture, established at the end of the Cold War. So it's exactly out of that that when you see it from the Kremlin's perspective, it suddenly becomes blindingly clear that the Cold War, far from being over as we thought about it in the West, was in fact never over.
To the extent that Putin's greatest ambition is to make Russia great again, how does the campaign to take back Ukraine fit into those ambitions?
Well, that's exactly the right phrase, it seems to me, to make Russia great again. And he uses history as a way of validating essentially hard Russian nationalism. So he in his various speeches before his war in Ukraine and then since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, Putin has bastardized history and provided a misreading of Russian history in which Russia, the Kremlin, claims ownership over Ukraine, and that Ukraine is no longer an independent nation, but simply an appendage to the Russian state. So this is, I think, one of the most striking things that the way to think about this, and it certainly was quite a shock when I discovered it, is that the director of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, so that's the equivalent of the CIA, but it's very different from the CIA, of course. So the director of the SVR is also the head of Russia's Historical Society. Hmm. So just to get that in perspective to your listeners, that would be like the director of the CIA also being the head of the American Historical Association. In other words, you know something strange is happening when that's the case. And sure enough, the kind of quasi-historical diatribes, essays that Putin and the Kremlin have produced before and during the war in Ukraine are all a way of sort of harking back to a mythologized past in terms of the Russia's great power status and nationhood. So what is this to get? That's a long way of getting at your question, Chris. How does this fit in with it? It is an attempt to make Russia great again by sort of capturing a mythologized past in which Russia owns Ukraine.
So while it's verifiably true that Putin is obsessed with stifling any expansion of NATO, is it realistic to think he probably would have pushed into Ukraine regardless?
Well, this is, as you quite rightly point out, this has been the big debate, hasn't it, since the war in Ukraine. To what extent is it, with the seeds of this conflict sown by NATO and expansion, US-led NATO expansion in the 1990s? Well, I think that my own view is that whatever NATO, it certainly didn't help, put it that way. NATO expansion fed on Putin and those in the Kremlin he surrounds himself, their worst fears. But fundamentally, Russia under Putin is a militarist mafia state. So there's a lot of discussion in policy circles at the moment, and particularly in this country, about the resurgence of great powers and great power competition. It seems to me that this is far too polite a term to be used with Putin's Russia. Essentially, and I have come to this conclusion by interviewing Russian defectors for my book, and the way that they describe it is that this essentially state within a state, the intelligence and security agencies, that Putin runs them as states within a state, and particularly the FSB penetrates effectively all aspects of the Russian economy. And what's its purpose? It has nothing to do with a kind of what we'd imagine the FBI does or a security agency in the West. The FSB's purpose is state-driven money laundering and criminal activities, all for the purpose of the personal enrichment of Putin and those close to him, the oligarchs. So the way to understand Putin's regime is more like a mafia syndicate than a great power of the past. And this gets back to your earlier question, Chris. It seems to me that Putin and those close to him, their use of history is a way of polishing the appearance of their criminal syndicate, which has captured Russia, and to make it more esteemed somehow. So if you understand Putin's regime, as I said, more like a mafia enterprise, then it begins to all make a lot more sense, in my view.
So what can covert operatives do to achieve Putin's goals that other branches of his government cannot?
Well, this builds on the long tradition of Soviet intelligence. And as I mentioned, Putin, being a former KGB officer, knows this at first hand. So all states, of course, use intelligence agencies to conduct foreign policy by non-avowed means, by clandestine means. So when states can't do something openly through open diplomacy, they often turn to their intelligence agencies to do things through the clandestine means. And that's true in the West and that's true in the East. So what can they do? What can Russia's do that open diplomacy cannot do? Well, the first and foremost, the difference is, as I just described them, all states do this. But the key thing to bear in mind is that in the West, intelligence agencies are overseen and constrained by a rule of law, by independent checks through Congress here, oversight, and of course, a free press. People like yourselves who are investigating the activities of intelligence agencies in open democratic societies. And none of that exists in Russia. So they are the executive branch of Putin's personal rule. What can they do that other branches and that open, like Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, what can the intelligence agencies do? Well, they can do things that would be unthinkable through open diplomacy. And in particular, there are a range of covert actions that Russia is the past and present master of. They don't call them covert action in the Kremlin. They call them active measures. And these are, if you like, they operate on a spectrum of different kinds of dirty tricks, ranging from propaganda, disinformation, to influence operations, recruiting people in target places, in for example, in the West, to become agents of influence, through to various forms of physical violence, up to and including assassinations. So what can intelligence agencies do? They can collect intelligence from clandestine means, human intelligence, signals intelligence, and they can carry out foreign policy in non-avowed ways. And they can also, and this is key to understand, as I just mentioned, influence world activities to the Kremlin's advantage through a variety of active measures.
I think for laypeople, you know, Vladimir Putin is just so inscrutable that it's always interesting to get a detail that reveals something about him. I had never read before that observers have noted Putin walks like an FSB officer.
It's really quite striking once you see it. That got pointed out to me by an FSB defector who I interviewed for my book. He said, oh, he's got the FSB gunslinger gait. I said, well, and then once you see it, it's absolutely blindingly clear. So any of your listeners, if you go and just sort of have a look right now, Google, he walks with his right hand motionless next to a sidearm, an invisible sidearm, and his left hand swinging. And this is, once you see it, this is in the Russian military tradition of I've got a weapon, I'm trained. Now, we all know, actually, that Putin has made much of his KGB past, in fact, too much, and that he was never the spy master or the master spy that he later claimed to have been. It seems to me, a very carefully choreographed image of the trained KGB officer, trained FSB officer with the invisible gun at his side. It's a very well manipulated image, it seems to me.
Calder, if there is one bit of comfort to be found here, it is that Vladimir Putin does not necessarily live up to this reputation he has cultivated for himself as like an evil genius and a spy master. Your sense is that he's really presided over a lot of intelligence failures during his tenure. So give us an example.
Well, that's quite right. And it's, as with so much in the Kremlin, it's really difficult to sort of unpack fact from fiction. He's made, as you just suggested, Chris, he's made much of his KGB past. But actually, if you scratch the surface, he isn't the spy master that he claims to have been. I've got it on good authority from a CIA source that Putin wanted to join, when he was in the KGB, the KGB's elite
group of deep cover illegals. These are KGB Soviet officers who posed undercover in the West. He wanted to become a deep cover illegal, but failed the training, the language training to do so. So that was the first sort of chip on his shoulder, it seems to me, in which he's, one doesn't need to be a psychologist to say perhaps he's been overcompensating for this ever since. And but more pragmatically, since he's been Russia's leader, he has, in fact, presided over a series of intelligence failures and security disasters. The most extreme, of course, being his reckless, counterproductive gamble to invade Ukraine in February 2022. So this was, it seems to me, an absolute, at root, intelligence failure. And it all stems from the fact that Putin and the nature of his rule means that he is never going to be provided with accurate intelligence. So the system that he's established, a lot like the worst of the Soviet dictators in the Kremlin before him, like Stalin, the nature of Putin's rule, where people close to him are very afraid for their own lives if they stray off course, that means that no one is going to be brave enough to tell him that he's wrong. And we saw this actually, if you remember, with the bizarre National Security Council, Russian National Security Council meeting on the eve of the invasion of Ukraine. And it was quite clear that it was heavily scripted, choreographed, and pre-recorded indeed as well, because people's, if you remember, the various people in the National Security meeting, their watches were all telling different times. But Putin's the head of his Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, Sergei Naryshkin, Putin humiliated him, if you remember that. And he said the words to the effect, no, we haven't got to that bit in the script yet. Because Naryshkin was sort of straying off course from the established script. Well, what was really going on there, it seems to me, was we don't know, because needless to say, there are not records that have been declassified. One day, hopefully, we will know about the nature of the intelligence that Putin was provided before his decision to invade Ukraine. But this fits in with a much longer term history in the Kremlin, by which an autocratic or dictator chooses to become his own intelligence assessor. In other words, I know better than my intelligence chiefs, and they are effectively there to confirm, not challenge, what I believe. That was certainly the case with Stalin, and his similar mishandling of intelligence in 1941. Before the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. There's a direct echo here, it seems to me, with Putin and his decision to invade Ukraine. So we don't know what intelligence he was provided with, but it seems pretty clear, judging from the humiliation of his SVR director, that perhaps the SVR director had hinted that this might not be a good idea. And that was the result that we saw in front of the world's media. So that's the most extreme, and I'm confident to say that when the history of the war in Ukraine comes to get written, either through the testimony of defectors or hopefully one day with records smuggled out of Russia, that we'll see this as a intelligence failure that Putin was primarily responsible for himself. But there have also been, just very quickly, Chris, there have been other episodes which Putin has presided over that are colossal embarrassments and failures for Russian foreign intelligence. In 2010, the US intelligence community, the CIA and the FBI, rounded up a collection, a spy network of deep cover illegals operating in the United States. This was an astonishing success for US intelligence, and a humiliating failure for Russian intelligence and Putin himself. Again, records aren't available, but query whether one day we'll find that humiliation of the success of US intelligence against his services contributed to Putin's risk calculations. In other words, I've been embarrassed on the world stage, and I need to try to prove how powerful Russia is going forward. So there have been a series of, that's another, so just that Operation Ghost Stories, as it was codenamed by the FBI, is one example. There have been another example is the failed assassination in Britain in 2018 to kill the person who Putin regards as a traitor and former MI6 spy, Sergei Skripal. It was an apps, as your listeners will probably remember from 2018, Russian operatives used a weapons-grade nerve agent to try to kill Skripal. Some people were indeed, two victims, I believe, were killed. And this was, it could have been an absolute huge public health emergency. And it's thankfully more people weren't killed, but they did in a kind of very cold, harsh way. If you're assessing the actual effectiveness of the operation, they did not kill their target, Sergei Skripal.
So today's FSB and SVR may be inheritors of the dynamics and the priorities of the old KGB before them. But of course, they have access to technology that KGB officers back in the day could scarcely have imagined. How does that affect the relative power of those intelligence agencies compared with the KGB?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. So when I was writing my book, I was fortunate enough to interview a former Eastern Bloc intelligence officer. So this was an officer from the Czechoslovakian Czech Security Intelligence Agency, the STB. And this man had defected to the US all the way back in 1968 after the Prague Spring, when he realized the barbarity of the regime that he was working for. And he was debriefed by the CIA. Now his story is important because in the Czech service, he was the head of the department that specialized in disinformation. So I asked his name, Larry Bittman, I asked Larry, looking at the world around us now of social media, how do you think this would compare to what you used to do in your previous profession? And he just put his hands up in the air and said, this is what we could only have dreamed of. So the underlying principles, the strategy is the same. The purpose of activities like disinformation to, as he said, my targets in the Western open media, I would be doing things like targeting wedge issues, as he said. So this would be, for example, race relations in the United States. And he would be forging documents that would then leak into the press in the West in order to aggravate existing grievances. So this is what he was doing in the 1960s. But he said now it's quicker, it's easier, and arguably more effective than ever before, thanks to social media, not only in terms of the transmission of disinformation, but also what these little tablets that we carry around with us all day on our phones, what they're doing to our, it seems to me, the way that we consume information. So we seem to have a sort of striking tendency to just believe what is otherwise falsifiable information as truth. And that indeed, we seem to be living in a post-truth era in many ways. So what is it that what is this new digital environment that we're all living in? What has it allowed hostile services across the world to do compared to the past? Well, do everything quicker, do everything cheaper, And I would say, looking at it from a historical perspective, do everything more effectively. And that is the key thing to understand, is this isn't necessarily some master puppeteer that is playing us all on strings. That was the sort of the impression one got after the 2016 revelations of Russia's electoral interference in 2016. It's not so much that they're sort of masterful puppeteers, but more that that active measures, covert action, disinformation, pushes at grievances that are already existing in our societies.
All right, Calder, U.S. foreign policy may never have fully achieved that pivot to Asia we keep hearing about, but we're going to try to do that in this conversation. I want to shift to China. Note that Beijing has carried out a war on U.S. intelligence since 2005. What is the goal of that effort?
Well, it's been evolving, Chris. So this is what was so striking to me finishing the research for this book, when I decided that it was really important to discuss China. So the book is a history of the 100-year intelligence war between Russia and the West. But of course, as I was finishing it, Russia under Putin and China under Xi have created an alliance with, quote, no limits. So they are aligned. And the striking thing, interviewing well-placed people with deep expertise on China, both in the British Foreign Office and in the US intelligence community, is that much earlier than we tend to think, Chinese intelligence carried out an onslaught, in their own words, a war on US intelligence. And as you just pointed out, Chris, this began in 2005. This was in the context of the post 9/11 war on terror, when all of US governments and its close allies like the UK, all of the resources in terms of intelligence and national security were being thrown at counterterrorism and dealing with some very real acute threats and plots. But in that period of the global war on terror, what was the US intelligence community and its allies doing about resurgent great powers like Russia and China? Well, necessarily far less than they would have done otherwise. And how did Chinese intelligence view this moment of the US war on terror? Well, from as one CIA officer, former CIA officer, explained it to me, their internal deliberations in China's Ministry of State Security were marked with, quote, glee and happiness, end of quote, as the US was mired in its counterterrorist operations in the Middle East. This was an opportunity for Chinese intelligence to attack the US intelligence community with the aim of supplanting it in Southeast Asia. Now, this is only the strategy has only increased and become more extreme since Xi came into power in Beijing. What is the overall intention? It is to supplant, well, there are on a number of different levels. The overwhelming priority for Chinese intelligence is to keep the Chinese Communist Party in power. Secondarily, it is to rival and supplant the US on the world stage as number one, becoming number one on the world stage. It's also, there's a cascade of other priorities, such as in the realm of technology. It is to make other countries in the world dependent not on US technology, but to invert that and to make them dependent on Chinese technology. This has all been at the risk of sounding immodest, but the conclusion of my book has been borne out in a report published by the UK Intelligence and Security Committee, published just 2 weeks ago. And it's called the China Report, and you can find it online. And it reveals the breadth and the scope of the Chinese intelligence onslaught far earlier than we would tend to have imagined in the West, with the intention of doing those things that I just outlined. And what's been the response of the UK government, because that report was focused on the UK, but it's also true, it seems to me, of the US, very little. And it's only now that the US government and other Western governments are realizing the extent to which, whilst they were looking in one direction, dealing with counterterrorism, states like China and Russia were concentrating their efforts against them, the West.
Calder, to the extent that Xi's goal, one of Xi's goals, is to make the world dependent on Chinese technology rather than American or Western technology, are Chinese spies as interested in corporate secrets as in military ones?
It's a great question, Chris. So this is, it seems to me, one of the great, it's an easy mistake to make when we're talking about or thinking about Chinese intelligence. And there's a lot of discussion at the moment, as you know, in the media about Chinese espionage, from the spy balloon a few months back to the Chinese spy site in Cuba. It's absolutely essential to understand that the Chinese Communist Party employs what it describes as a whole of society approach to intelligence collection. So that's to say all of the components of its society are harnessed to collect intelligence on its targets, particularly the United States. So this is not just about spy agencies, if you like, that we think about with the 20th century's Cold War, the KGB and the CIA and MI6. As far as Chinese intelligence is concerned today, intelligence collection fuses the intelligence agencies with corporate businesses. So under a series of draconian laws passed under Xi, Chinese businesses are obliged to cooperate whenever they are asked to do so with Chinese security and intelligence. This means that effectively Chinese businesses, corporations doing business with the outside world, their silent partners in those activities are always going to be the Communist Party of China, in particular the Ministry of State Security. So there's a blending of security and business, making a kind of authoritarian business model, the likes of which are completely alien to those of us here in the West. And that's what's, I think, really important to understand, that it's not simply about spy agency versus spy agency. It's a whole of society approach. And what does that mean? Well, if we're on the receiving end of a whole of society onslaught, we necessarily also need to have a strategy that involves a whole of society. So this, in the West, means the private sector being alert to the power of Chinese intelligence and its tentacles when dealing business with China. And I think that this, Chris, is only really a public policy conversation that's only just starting to happen right now in the West. We're doing better here in the US than we are in some countries in Europe. And as I mentioned, that report that was published in the UK just 2 weeks ago is hopefully a wake-up call of a public policy conversation that should have been happening a long time ago.
Well, it's easy to understand how China could use surveillance of its own citizens to coerce them to behave in certain ways. What could China do with all the personal data it's collecting about American civilians?
Well, any number of things. And this is, we are all wondering what its actual purpose is, but you're quite right. China's intelligence strategy across domains in the, you know, from the traditional human intelligence, spies in the cyber realm, signals intelligence, you name it, across all the different domains is collect, collect, collect. It is collecting data. Quite what it will do with that data is really anyone's guess. But some things are pretty clear. The massive hacks that the Chinese government has undertaken in the West, for example, the Office of Personnel Management hack, I forget the exact date, I think it was 2015, 2016, although your listeners can point out if I've got that wrong. This was an enormous hack conducted by Chinese operatives into some of the most sensitive data held by the US federal government. So when employees are going through background security checks and they have to answer incredibly personal details in order to get their security clearance, in which they're polygraphed and they discuss things about, you know, their personal lives, be it extramarital affairs, substance abuse, that kind of thing. Things that in some cases we can imagine an applicant would even keep secret from his or her own family. That database containing that material was breached and hacked by Chinese operatives. Now, this offers a goldmine of potential compromising material in which to potentially blackmail people working in the US federal government. So again, putting this, I put this operation, posed it to old Russia hands in the CIA, and they just said, one can only imagine what the KGB would have done with this information. So this is unfortunately, it's a picture that's still evolving as to what China will do with it. But in the broader terms, this century will be dominated by data. We can already tell that. And whoever controls the data will be master of this century. So China is collecting and collecting and collecting. It doesn't have to deal with the niceties, I'm saying that sarcastically, of law and order, of oversight, of a free press. It is simply limited by what it can get away with. And that's the same as Russia as well. In terms of collecting data, both on its own citizens and overseas. And then the question will be the race to understand, to master that data. And what will happen with that through machine learning and artificial intelligence, how that data can be manipulated on targets, that will be, it seems to me, the story of this century. And these are the tools that I think all governments are racing to master in the same way they will be artificial intelligence, machine learning, and quantum computing will be the equivalent this century as nuclear weapons were in the last century.
Calder, how has the job for U.S. and Western intelligence services, the job of collecting intelligence in closed states like Russia and China, changed in the digital era? What is easier and what is more difficult now?
Well, so Russia and China are as hard targets for Western services as it's possible to imagine. So Russia, the Soviet Union, was always a colossally difficult target, any of the countries behind the Iron Curtain. But that's only increased now with the ubiquitous technical surveillance, to use the sort of the technical terms, the Orwellian digital authoritarian states that have been created in China and Russia with facial recognition, QR codes to get in and out of buildings and so on. So you can imagine this is colossally difficult for Western services to operate in China or on Chinese targets, given that level of surveillance. But it's not all doom and gloom. I would like to point out that the open source, commercially available intelligence is a game changer for Western services. So we know that during the last century's Cold War, about 80% of the intelligence that arrived on the desk of the president came from clandestine collection, from signals intelligence, intercepts from human intelligence, and so on, and about 20% from open sources. Well, now in the digital era, that is understood to be completely reversed, the other way around. So 80% from open source or commercially available satellite imagery, for example, open source data from social media, and only about 20% from clandestine collection. We are living through an absolute revolution in terms of intelligence and national security. And the forefront of that revolution is open source intelligence. There's now so much more intelligence that is available to be collected and then analyzed by data scientists through open sources than there ever was before in history. And we can point to some outfits that are doing really extraordinary work in terms of uncovering the clandestine activities of hostile governments in ways that would have been colossally difficult intelligence operations for services in the past. So the outfit Bellingcat, they are doing some remarkable reporting using openly available, commercially available intelligence about Russian hostile activities against the West. And if your listeners don't know Bellingcat, I highly encourage anyone listening to go and have a look at their website. Likewise, with Chinese intelligence, I would point you in the direction of a strategic intelligence provider called Strider Technologies. And they're doing some extraordinary research, again, on Chinese intelligence activities in the West. Their one report called the Los Alamos Report reveals how Chinese scientists who were working at Los Alamos and then returned to China brought with them sensitive research projects from Los Alamos, which then were incorporated into China's defense industries. It's quite ironic, of course, that this is at Los Alamos, happening yet again. And look, when you see it from a historical perspective, Los Alamos, of course, as we all saw in the wonderful film recently, the home of where the atomic bomb was invented, but it was also the site where Soviet spies also stole the plans for the world's first atomic bomb, which then accelerated the Soviet Union's own atomic bomb project. So secrets are similarly hemorrhaging to China, as this report reveals. And that report is all based on open source collection, all available out there that has been processed. But what this means, Chris, is that actually intelligence agencies in the West are really having to, they're being asked some difficult questions from policymakers, from their customers, and quite right so, which is, in other words, if we can read this through forensic digital analysis, through media outlets, through Bellingcat, through newspapers, through Strider Technologies, what are you guys, the intelligence community, doing? And so they're really having to also, they're being forced to question or to come up with answers as to what the margin is that they can produce in this new era. It can go two ways, it seems to me, as we progress forward in this new environment. Either Western intelligence agencies can incorporate directly open source and commercially available intelligence into their products. If we go down that route, which I think there's a lot of discussion about that in Washington at the moment, intelligence, we would need to redefine what we think of intelligence, and no longer being the secret service, perhaps, of the past, no longer James Bond, I'm afraid, and more about data collection. And first and foremost, being what is available from open sources. And then perhaps that analysis is supplemented by clandestine collection. That's one way. Another way would be actually to let the open source intelligence community do their thing, and for intelligence communities to concentrate more conservatively on those niche areas that, even with the best open source intelligence available, can't be gleaned from it. So traditional human intelligence, or certain types of highly sophisticated signals intelligence. I have a feeling that bureaucracies, being such as they are, there are vested interests in the US intelligence community to say, we will adapt our mission and we will do this and incorporate open source into our capabilities. Whether that is actually the best thing in terms of a division of resources, I think that that is a really important question that has not really begun to be asked in terms of this public policy conversation at the moment.
Calder Walton is a historian at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs and author of Spies, the Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. Calder, thank you very much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.